we have a lane of taking our story and turning it into content and wisdom so that they can understand what those things look like. But there can be the cult of one, where someone does abusive behaviors that sound a lot like what we went through. There can be things that go on at work that happen. There can be all sorts of abuses of power and coercion that go on that aren't cults, but they're a little bit culty. If that becomes the modality that people accept, it's ultimately going to get worse. And I think people also have to recognize the darkness lives in all of us. You're not going to shame someone out of their own darkness. Whenever I see something I disagree with online, I read a comment that supports my disagreement. If I feel good about that comment, I know I still got work to do.
You're listening to the Real Business Connections Network.
Real Business Connections Network.
Powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC. Subscribe now and check us out at realbusinessconnections.com. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, once again to Learn, Speak, Teach on the Real Business Connections Network. I'm here today with Nippy Ames. Nippy, what's happening, man? How are you?
I'm doing great. Just in the grind of the day-to-day in our routine and doing, I think, our third podcast this week.
Dude, rock and roll. And this is back.
Full-time podcaster. Yeah.
We'll get into that a little bit, Colty. We're doing back-to-back. I don't necessarily think someone needs to turn this off and go to the Sarah episode, but I think they're both valuable in themselves. But Sarah was part one of this two-part series. You are numero dos, and you guys co-host a Little Bit Colty podcast together, right?
Correct. Yep.
Because, I mean, you guys are in a cult. You got out, and now you're really getting the wisdom and knowledge and tips and red flags and kind of the nuanced understanding from the people who have it, experts, survivors, and shedding light on people like me that haven't been part of a cult, but you're also really helping people that are healing, right? Is that the main mission behind
the
show?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it covers a spectrum. You know, our process is how'd you get in? What'd you think you were signing up for? How'd you get out, and what are you doing to recover? So normally we have our guests on, if they've been in a certain situation, those are the questions we get into. But our podcasts also range from experts to journalists who've covered it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what's interesting, some of our most interesting episodes, I think, have come from some of the journalists, because a lot of the journalists go into it thinking they know what they're looking at. Similarly with, you know, legal experts as well. And a lot of the times they're in a position where they have to educate themselves on what they're looking at, because a lot of it's coercive control. And if you look at our culture and society, our justice system does a really good job of clamping down on physical abuses, which is why our jails are full of people with physical crimes. But normally the physical abuse are symptomatic of what has been going on emotionally a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. And our education systems, our judicial systems don't really have a sound process for identifying those and holding those accountable. So in our case, coercive control is kind of the lane that we've been able to emerge as. And like I told you before the podcast, one of the things that is opened up to Sarah and I, for whatever reason, is we have a lane of taking our story and turning it into content and wisdom so that they can understand what those things look like. And the title of it, A Little Bit Culty, I think is perfect, because not everything's extreme. We're going to go, you know, to Jim Jonestown massacre, or it's going to be Charles Manson or Koresh or Keith Raniere, but there can be the cult of one, where someone does abusive behaviors that sound a lot like what we went through. There can be stuff that go on at, there can be things that go on at work that happen. There can be all sorts of abuses of power and coercion that go on that aren't cults, but they're a little bit culty. And I always said that the abuses of power that go on in cults aren't proprietary to cults. They go on in a lot of other day-to-day things that we're a part of, and understanding what those red flags are, understanding what they look like, sound like, only informs people to make better decisions so they can run, do something about it or whatever.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, because it's a business podcast. I talked with this and Sarah, it's a business podcast, but I like to believe I give people what they need, and it's allowing people like you to tell your story and giving some of the nuanced understandings and not just the tactical stuff, but some of the intuitive stuff that they don't teach in a typical business course. And that's why I kind of want to ask you, like, let's say I have a leader that something feels off, but I don't quite know why. What are some of the red flags or things that I should be looking for that maybe the leader or the team I'm a part of isn't actually serving me?
Well, that's a great question. And I think one, it all starts with the feeling of what you think you see. And I think the first thing when you have that feeling, it's important to put language to what it is that you think you see. A lot of the times we have these feelings and there's a deficit of language around what we're feeling, seeing, and sometimes it's not easy to quantify it and say what it is, right? Generally speaking, I mean, there's a lot of them. The guru is a big one. If there's one person with all the answers, I think that's generally do some homework and challenge. If you challenge and you get pushback and it's made to look like you're the one that's a problem when you're just airing a grievance, that's a problem. If there's not transparency, if there's a problem, if you leave, you know, are you shunned when you leave? You know, one of the things, and I'll come back and give you a more thorough answer, but as you were describing your podcast, we did an episode with a guy named Cameron Harold, who is the CEO of 1-800-I-GOT-JUNK. And he saw the vow and he reached out to us, and he's from Vancouver. And when we were living in Vancouver, you know, the gist of, you know, what he built his business on is like, you want a cult-like atmosphere, somewhat tongue in cheek. And we did an episode with him, and I learned a lot after the episode, because a lot of people I realized that I was insensitive to certain things, and I still had blind spots in terms of recognizing certain power dynamics and how dependencies are made. And one of the things I think Cameron said on the podcast was like, you know, if you're in that situation, quit, you know, just leave. And one of the people responded and said, listen, some of us just can't quit. We have health insurance. We have a lot of things tied up in these things, right? Now, I'm not here to say the CEO knows that and knows that he has a dependent workforce on him and that allows him to do whatever he wants, but that relationship does exist, and it exists in governments. It exists in a lot of other hierarchies. And if you're in a situation where you're part of an entity that you think is doing good, or you find out it's not, and then you want to uproot and leave, and you have a job that's, you know, you have two kids, you have a mortgage, it's not easy. In a lot of ways, you're not necessarily in a cult per se, but you're in a dynamic where, I can't leave. I'm dependent and I can't go challenge this authority or narrative because I have so many things dependent on my believing in this narrative. And now I'm not calling that culty. I'm calling that's just unfortunate the way business structures are set up, but that can exist. And you can have someone in a position of, say, CEO who's tyrannical like that and knows that dynamic, and it allows them to abuse their power in ways that you can't foresee when you take the job. And you're taking the job maybe where you don't have a kid or a mortgage yet. And then later on, there's kind of a thing where you're in a tough position. So those aren't culty per se. That's why I say it's a little bit culty, because, you know, the power dynamic is off. So, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, red flags, you know, particularly when you get into religion. You know, a lot of times, people outsource I call it appealing to authority. You see it everywhere, particularly now. You see it in medicine, you see it in politics, you see it, but particularly in the churches, that we see, it's the same narrative. They refer to God. It's not, if you object to them, they basically just outsource it and say, well, would God accept this? And, you know, is this God's will? And those sorts of things. Those are major abuses.
They've got
power.
God on speed dial. They can give them
exactly.
A call.
And those are, and, you know, and when I look at how it goes on, you know, those people have a lot of people loyal to God, and they can leverage that however they see fit. Look at history. I mean, you can find a lot of things where they've done a lot of things. Normally it's money, sex, and power is really what it boils down to. And I think if you feel those red flags, listen to them, you know, do a proper inquiry, and then look at the organization's wake. You know, is there people in the past that have been damaged, and do they dismiss the abuse? Do they dismiss the damage? Do they make comments that are very dismissive of people who had problems previously, and they're not sensitive to it? Well, understand that's you next, right? Because once you start questioning, you know, that's how they're going to treat you. So on an unconscious level, you're being trained to not challenge authority. So challenging authority is a big one, and leaving, if leaving is difficult, is another big one.
Thank you for sharing that, specifically that last part. So I was in a sales role back in the day, and the way they taught sales, it worked for them. It worked for the CEO without, you know, throwing anybody under the bus. He was a big, strong, athletic dude with a ton of authority, great connections, and he spoke in an authoritarian way where it was all yes, no questions, and it was kind of like bully approach. And I'm like this soft, introverted, introspective guy, and I would ask questions, and I would try to determine their why. Then I would try to weave in my conversation based around their why. And then I would find the product service offering that fit what served them. But me doing that was immediately muted because it was so different than the sales structure at the company. Doesn't mean the sales structure is bad. Doesn't mean my way is better. But that scenario means I'm in an environment that's toxic to where I could be. And that's kind of a red flag that even if this company isn't bad or a cult, maybe I'm in the wrong spot. And you mentioned if it becomes my fault, I'm just a bad person, I'm terrible, I was never meant to be in sales, maybe it is a little extra culty that it's my fault just for having a different style.
Yeah, it's what, and that's the fine line, right? So you have kind of a dogmatic way of doing things where numbers are the bottom line, results are the bottom line. And I think when people are all about results, they tend to make, like you want their why, they make the sales about them and what they can get from it rather than what the product can offer the other person. And I mean, that's not a bad thing per se, but it's problematic because they're not really being honest and authentic about their intent. The sale's for them, not for the other person. And so you see, and that process isn't particularly proprietary to sales. You know, you see governments, you see politicians. Once the office starts to serve them and they're not serving the office, it's kind of the beginning of the end for whatever it is that comes out of their mouth. You know, and some people just pursue office because they want the power. And they're just lying about it. And that, you know, that's going to exist in no matter what entity that you go into. I mean, even where I'm coaching right now, I'm watching coaches live their dreams through their kids. It's doomed to fail because you can't build the fire in your kid. You can nurture it, but you can't build it. And if it's your fire, it's not going to, the kid's going to quit. So it's the kid serving the father's ego more than the father serving the child's dream. And normally people get a hit of that. You can feel it, but you don't have language for it. And then as you have enough experience of it, you can go, oh, this is what this guy's doing.
So this is happening in plain sight all the time. One thing I love about, I told Sarah, I've been binging on the podcast. What I love about it is, it seems like you're never going to run out of opportunity to have discussions around this kind of stuff, because everywhere we go, there's abuses of power. There's people manipulating human behavior for their own benefit. And us ordinary people don't realize it's happening, do we?
That's unfortunately true.
Yeah.
Our podcast probably won't go out of business anytime soon. All that said, This is, you know, what I think our education systems need. People aren't changed by your opinion. They're changed by your example. And I try to be as close to what I say and be the example of that. And ideally, you can create more of the example rather than being a part of the vision of calling people out. And we're in a pretty weird time right now, but I don't think it's necessarily new. You know, it's just information can't be controlled in the way that it could be, and people aren't as obedient. So people are, it's a free for all in information. And I think it's an opportunity for human beings to go, hey, this is a human problem, not an internet problem. And we can stop doing this and destroying everything that's been built previously if we can kind of start to serve our human team a little bit better. And hopefully our podcast can be an example of that in that ecosystem and that space for as long as it's needed. I'd love to put us out of business.
Well, right? Well, it's that tribal us versus them mentality has been going on forever. Nowadays, one thing that I recall listening to your podcast, you mentioned you're purple. You're not blue. You're not red. You're like, I'm purple. And just the concept of being moderate probably pisses some of your audience off, right?
They won't let us. They won't let us. It's like, it's really funny. We've been called Trumpers and we've been called libtards off of the same episode. So, you know, I joke with Sarah, you know, because at first we were a little sensitive to it. And we're just like, look, that's the space we're in. Like, and I told her, I was like, do you know that there was an Elvis impersonator contest in Las Vegas that Elvis went to and didn't win?
The real Elvis?
The real Elvis. And I was like, that's such a commentary on people just won't give you what you are. Like, I just felt like that was like, so even if we are an example of what we think other people, you know, want to see, some people just won't give it to you for whatever reasons. And they've predetermined that. And I'm not saying we are by any stretch of the means, but I've really done struggle to maybe at times to not be a part of the division and want to be a part of the conversations that unite us. And there's plenty of things that can unite us. Anytime you have an opinion though, I think people are just, you know, they'll come after you a little bit. And my favorite is when they send you links.
Wow.
You know, I've said some things before where, here are the links. So they just appeal to authority, and that's just a shortcut to thinking. Like, what are the ideas that I'm saying that you have a problem with? Let's talk about ideas. And people aren't talking about ideas. They just double down on the party that they're loyal to, or the identity politics of the time. And, you know, there's books on it, Aldous Huxley, 1984. It's like people are loyal to the party. And that to me is the tribalism you speak of, to the identity politics that you speak of, and dare I say a little bit culty, you know? So, you know, everyone has their uniforms on. For me, neither of the uniforms fit particularly. Mm-hmm. I think there's some valuable points on either sides of the aisle. And I think there's plenty of stuff to unite us, but the people that are loyal to the party just won't allow it. And that's where I say they're being a little bit culty. And we could sit here for days on how they do it. And I'm pretty sensitive to the tactics of how they do it, particularly how they do it with religion and then how they do it with fringe ideas on the left. But again, you know, I'm not going to stop calling it out. And if it offends your dogma, then take a look. You know, that's an opportunity for you. It's not me that's the problem. It's me challenging the dogma. And maybe my ideas aren't perfect, my opinions aren't perfect, but I call out process and I call out abuses of power, I think, with a pretty strong acumen based on my experience. And so that's my lane. So I'm not going to back down from that. I will certainly take a constructive criticism, but if it's attacking Sarah's character or my character based on an idea, you've outed yourself to me. So.
Well, you just said it. You're calling out an abuse of power. And abuse of power isn't a single race or region or idea. Right. This is very pervasive across the board, I can only imagine. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate you guys having those discussions, because if we don't have the discussion, nothing is really accomplished. And the one thing that always has triggered me is read this book. And it's like...
Yeah. Well, that's send you the link.
If I have to read a 300-page book to be knowledgeable enough for you to explain in simple terms what the problem is, like if you can't explain in 4 to 6 sentences what the issue is and I need to read the book, I don't know. It's I'd be reading books nonstop. Like, you got to put a little bit of faith in people's words and start a dialogue. and understand the story. And I'm kind of on a tangent, but that's one thing that I love about what you guys are doing is you're not saying this is the way, this is correct, we're always right in everything we say. You're just on a journey sharing your story. Is that correct?
Yeah. And yeah, for the most part, I mean, you know, I'm going to slip up and have some strong opinions here and there based on my experience. And, you know, that might trigger certain people. And it also, you know, I'm as sensitive to the people that triggers as opposed to the people that like double down with me. They're like, I totally agree with you here. And that's sometimes where I have to go, wait a minute, am I leading a dogma by having someone like, of course there's gonna be people that agree with you, right? And that doesn't mean you're right. And most people go to the internet to validate their belief system, not challenge it, right? So, and there's algorithms that if you click on one thing, you know, I started clicking on extreme right stuff about 2 or 3 years ago because I didn't know what QAnon was and I didn't really follow it. And so I started just watching it.
Yeah.
You know, and then my Twitter feed started getting all these right wing, all these conservative pundits in my feed. Probably because they thought I was going down that rabbit hole, but I was really just trying to get some intel before for a podcast or whatever. And then I went and did some left stuff and they started sending me stuff. I've confused the algorithm.
Let's think about that though, because you're the audience, you're the product. They want to be able to feed you ads. They want to be able to keep you on their platform. There's a little bit of coercion going on. They don't necessarily have Nippy's best interest in mind when he's scrolling through his feed. They have the interest of what they've built. And again, that's pervasive in a lot of these groups, right?
For sure. And we did, I think our third episode was with a woman who reached out to us. Her name was Samantha. And she found herself in the QAnon rabbit hole. And it was because someone she was in love with had gone down that rabbit hole and was basically showing her all the things of the right and sending her YouTube videos. Now, she went into it with open eyes, trying to just be there for her boyfriend, and slowly started listening to her boyfriend, watching herself do it, and then agreeing with it, and found herself in this group, high up in the group, helping out with this group, and to the point where I think she was peripheral to the event in Charlottesville where the cars ran over some people and there was a big riot or whatever. And that's when she snapped out of it. She's like, wow, I actually was peripheral to this event. To me, it was such an interesting episode for us because she does a really good job of articulating. I went down the rabbit hole on YouTube knowing that I was looking at this stuff just to be there for my boyfriend and found myself indoctrinated to this stuff. So if this is, you know, a 23, 24-year-old that I perceived as someone who's pretty smart, imagine, you know, the mistake a 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old kid can make just tangentially going through a YouTube video and then coming back and having dogmatic beliefs about something with nothing to contrast it. So that's very real. And I think it's important for people to understand that that's out there. And then understand what it looks like and sounds like. So
I don't have children of my own, but my girlfriend has two. Neither of us are perfect in the whole parental realm, but I think it poses a real question here. Since you realize that this is possible, I mean, everybody has a phone at their fingertips. How do you try to ensure that your kids do remain curious and they don't follow your dogma or the dogma they found online or the dogma or just the personality of their friends? Like, how do you ensure their individuality when a world is always sending them marketing messages? And it seems difficult.
Well, the short answer is I don't have a definitive answer. I do think it needs to be a collective effort from schools and parents. And schools and parents have their opinions. I think it's also important if a child comes to you to demonstrate that you know how to question and in teaching them to question. I can give a pretty good example of where I feel like I was successful on it one time. I was listening to a podcast kind of on low in my car. And because I didn't really want, I was just kind of researching while I was dropping off to school. And I was noticing in the podcast, like, it really wasn't a good faith conversation it was an interview. And it wasn't really a good faith conversation amongst the interviewer to the interviewee. And the person seemed a little railroaded. And my son in the back seat goes, "Dad, why does that woman keep putting words in his mouth?" Oh, no. Why does she keep changing the words that he's saying? My kid's 8.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, because that's exactly what I was thinking. But when I was 8, I didn't even know what that meant.
Right.
I was like, how do you do that? And I said, but he was hearing how this woman was railroading this guy on the interview. And I had a discussion for him. I waited, like, he was late for school for 5-10 minutes because I thought that was the best time I could spend with him than anything he was going to get in there. And I said, well, that's what some people do. And, you know, and so I think if you're educated on it and you're educated as best as you can, they'll be able to walk into situations and be able to see the symptoms pretty quickly. Right. They'll be able to, and I can tell how he argues a little bit. He's adept in that. And Sarah and I are in it. And so we have kind of a PhD in that. But for the parents that don't know that, I think you're going to have to be diligent with what your kids watch. And I think if parents aren't doing that now, they don't have a good understanding of that. They've been living under a rock because there's ample evidence for them to know that their kids are going to be really susceptible no matter what. And just to have an open dialogue and not make anything they come back with bad. Which is hard, like, because you, as a parent, any kind of, I don't want to call it failure, or anything that you kind of feel is going on with your kid, adversity, the kid is an effective you, and it's just not. The world's like that, and you're going to have to be a sounding board for them. And if you don't create an atmosphere where they can come back and talk to you about it, you're not that sounding board. Someone else will be, and someone else will be with probably not their best interests at heart. So that's my token answer, I think.
I love it. It's open communication. Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of reminding me, you do kind of want to pick someone up when they're down and say, you got this, it's going to be okay. They're just a bully. But at some point, we need to think for ourselves. Like, life isn't just sunshine and rainbows.
Yep.
Talk a little bit about love bombing. Not that we're love bombing our kids, but there's like a toxic positivity that everything's going to be okay. Everything's all right. Don't worry about it. This or that. When that's not the case, like, we're going to go through shit in life. Are we not?
If you're doing it right. Right. Like, and it, I'm a big proponent of front loading the failure.
Okay.
You know, I even told my son this, you know, last year. It's like, you front load the failure just so you know failure is a part of it. And it's going to be hard. It's supposed to be hard. You know, I show him videos and I show him things like this of people that he likes, you know, like Tom Brady, Michael Jordan, athletes. Athletes, I find, are a really good one, because athletes is one of the things that it's very hard to make political. You either hit the shot or you don't.
Right.
You know what I mean? So there's no
faking can only it. There can only be one GOAT, though, Nippy. There can only be one greatest. You know that, right?
that's fine. That's fine. I mean, if you're competing and you know how to compete, I think that that's a healthy thing, because the laws of cause and effect are your domain, right? There's no like cheating that.
Right.
And how you think and feel about that kind of doesn't matter. Right? Like, you can get upset when you hit the shot, but there's a solution to why you're not hitting the shot. More reps, right? Not your emotions getting upset. And so if you can kind of get a sense of that and then take those tenets and apply them to your life, love bombing, all that stuff is kind of secondary to what you know the objective to be in whatever endeavor that you're on. So if my son is failing a test, or he's not doing well in mathematics and he loves mathematics, and he came back and he's like, it's hard now. I was like, well, yeah, it's hard because you're going to the next level. And that's how going to the next level is going to be. Like, it's supposed to be hard. If you want to get good at it, it's supposed to be hard. And then you deepen your understanding of mathematics and you deepen your understanding of yourself. And that was it. That's all you need to hear. And he went off and he kind of like, and got frustrated, but he gets frustrated with little things like putting his shoes on, you know, like, it's too tight. And I'm like, all right, well, what's the solution? You know? And there's a lot of coddling, I think, is the question that you were alluding to.
Yeah.
As it pertains.
I didn't learn how to tie my shoes. I didn't learn how to tie my shoes until I was like 12, 13 years old. I had someone do it for me. I don't think that helped me in any way.
Yeah, setting them in the problem.
Yeah.
Knowing that they're going to have some help if it gets too hard is a good thing. I don't think my dad dropped me in the pool to swim. It was a little extreme. I mean, for the most part, I mean, he'd help, but like, it was like, he made me figure it out. I'm not going to do that. Well, he already learns how to swim, but my point is there are ways to remedy that as it pertains to love bombing. I think love bombing, I think, generally has the presupposition that whatever they're loving you on is inauthentic. Hmm. It's like, oh, you're so whatever. They're lying because they have an ulterior motive. So, and normally you can feel that. You know, I had an experience when I first met the president of Nexium when I went up there because I had an old friend tell her about me, the person that enrolled me. She's like, oh my God, Nippy, it's so great to finally meet you, blah, blah. I was like, yeah, let's slow your roll. Slow your roll. I wasn't like, it didn't work on me. I'm not a big like lovey-dovey, like, hey, that's, you know, just get to know me. You don't have to pretend like you think I'm great without ever knowing me.
Yeah,
I didn't buy it. And it isn't to say that I wasn't susceptible to those tactics. I was susceptible in different ways. Love bombing just isn't one of them. It just never was. I'm from four boys, and like our currency was sarcasm and anger. So it wasn't so much. Whereas there was no love bombing. Love bombing to me immediately reeked of inauthenticity. So it just wasn't my number.
It wasn't your number. I want to talk about your number in just a second. But while we're on this, one thing, and I think I read it in Sarah's book, but between, you know, The Vow from HBO, Sarah's book Scarred, and then a little bit culty, it's just so much tremendous information. But it seemed as if the higher status you were walking into a possible Nexium situation, you're showing up for a 5-day, the higher status you were, the more coercive the manipulation was to bring them on board. Like, they were love bombed more, or Nancy would fly out to be there, and all leadership was there. And it's like, what, why are they all here all of a sudden? And it was because, you know, these people have money, or these people have social proof that. So talk a little bit about that, because it's, I talked about this with Sarah. I have a marketing background. Social proof's everything.
Absolutely.
They were using social proof in a manner to manipulate and use people, which is not okay. That doesn't mean social proof's bad, but they're using the shit out of it. Talk about how that social proof worked, and there's a strategy behind it, I imagine.
As I've come to learn and witness peripherally, I think if anyone could bring more value to the organization, you're going to get more attention. So the Bronfmans in particular, they weren't going to let the Bronfmans get away.
And they were cash super rich.
The Seagram's heiress from Edgar Bronfman Sr.
Okay.
And that's the Seagram's family.
Billionaire family.
And they weren't going to let them get away. So they made them important. They were susceptible to being made feel important. They were given positions of power. Unearned through the traditional strategies of how things should work in a meritocracy, but because they are wealthy, they are quickly in a position where they were making decisions so as to feel they were responsible for the organization and its successes and failures. And so there was a little bit of coercion and obligation. Well, you didn't do this, you didn't do this, and put your money here, put your money there. And it was and Keith hit the lottery with that. He hit the lottery with that. And then, you know, as a result of them, they were able to bring on the Dalai Lama. Then the credibility, the celebrity, whatever, what was the term you used? The marketing.
Social proof.
Social proof was
third party validation. And
it was one of the things. Had I known how it was achieved, I think my decisions may have been different. Right. But, you know, I thought the Dalai Lama was coming on based on his experience of Keith. I thought other people, and that brought in other people, celebrities. Although I found celebrities more of a pain in the ass than anything else, because they tended to demand more, and they came in with kind of a special thing, or maybe they just knew their value and they're like, look, I'm not going to do this. But I found like it was slow going with them. They didn't really translate well, except that you could just go out and say, hey, so-and-so did our training. They liked it and endorsed it, that sort of thing. But, you know, it was interesting to see, in the first 3 years, I think were able to get the new, so it was when I first joined, it was when the Enron scandal was happening. And a guy named Stephen Cooper was the new interim CEO of the Enron. And they were able to get him and his staff of 25 people to do a training in New York City. This is like, wow, in 2003. Huh. So there was a lot of things that were going on, that they were able to get a lot of influential people. And I say that not to say that the curriculum was great. I say it to let people know that if you don't think you're susceptible to this type of thing, mm-hmm, and you're the kind of person who has your arms folded, I was that guy.
Right.
I was that guy at 27 who was like, prove it. You know, I was in the back of the room skeptical. Right. Now, that might not be enough for you to change your mind, but I'll say this, if you don't think you're susceptible to it, and I'm a guy who's a narcissistic sociopath and I have something, I'm targeting you because you think you're not susceptible to it. I know your blind spot now.
A lot of mentalists and hypnotists say, oh, that person who doesn't think they're going to be hypnotized, or the easiest to hypnotize, or the freshest bait in terms of, oh, I like this challenge. Now, that's not always necessarily coming from a manipulative place, but if you have the capacity, you like that challenge, I can only imagine. Sarah and I were talking about it. I literally, like, it makes me puke in my mouth. I can't imagine living that life, but they don't have the same stimulus response physiology that they and I do.
They don't. And I can shed some light onto that if you want.
Please, yeah.
If I'm one of those people, right, I know for the most part that you have a morality and you have a conscience, right? Now, I'm aware that I don't, but I know what it looks like and sounds like for people to have a morality and conscience, right? And I know how to emulate it.
Right.
Right. So I also know how to elicit.
Yeah.
Right. So I can figure out your boundaries pretty quickly, and I can get you to push on them. I can understand where you begin and where you don't through my questions. And I know what I'm looking at. I know your vulnerabilities, your weak spots, et cetera. Now, what you don't know is that I don't give a shit about any of that. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I want that information is how to use you as a pawn or a chess piece if I need you. I might not need you right now, but I remember you're the guy who cares about this, so I'm gonna keep an eye on you. And what you also don't know is that I don't have a conscience and there's nothing I won't do. But you think that I have a conscience. You don't know what it's like to not have a conscience because you've always had one. I've never had one. The spectrum of options for me opens up tenfold because I don't have a morality. There's nothing stopping me internally from abusing my power. And I will lie to no end. I will lie to your face to no end. You will catch me. I will lie to no end. And there's nothing I won't do or say to keep my narrative more realistic than yours. And that's a scary thing. And there's people like that, I think, that run companies. You know, because in order to be somewhat successful in certain domains, you can't have a conscience that's stopping you from making decisions. You just can't. And so one of the things, and I don't care about banging it on Donald Trump anymore than he's been banging on. I don't think it's a difficult thing to not like Donald Trump, but Donald Trump has always been who he said he's going to be since I was 12, 13 years old. I've always looked at that guy and been like, yeah, that's about Donald Trump and that's who he is. But one of the things that I think that allows him to keep going forward in the way that he does, because he just doesn't give a shit. It just falls off him and he doesn't get, like, Sarah and I were in the peripheral of litigation with Claire Bronfen for 6 months, and my fight or flight was going off every single morning. I was waking up at 2 or 3 a.m. going, holy fucking shit, excuse my language, right? And it was awful. It was an awful thing to go through, right? It's like, is this going to be the rest of my life? He's got thousands of those going on at any given time, and he's just like, I don't care. I'm doubling down. And I remember watching, sorry if this gets a little tangential, but I think it's a good example of how this psychology works. You know Dana White?
Yes.
The mixed martial arts guy who mm-hmm. who does the whole thing.
UFC.
There, I saw an interview with him, and he was talking about Donald Trump. And Donald Trump came to Dana White when he was starting out his mixed martial arts, his whole venture. Didn't have a venue. He didn't have anything. And Dana White, I'm going to interview him. He's like, this guy calls me and says, use my space, use Trump Plaza, blah, 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 and help me out and got me on my feet and blah, 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 and help me. And help me become successful. And it's like, I'm not here to have this conversation if it wasn't for Donald Trump. Hmm. And I was like, oh, Trump is, he's smart. He's smart in a conniving way. And what I started figuring out is, you know, and then Trump calls in that favor to Dana White when he's running for president and say, will you speak at my convention? Mm-hmm. And Dana White saying, I struggled with it because all my friends said it'll be the death of you and blah, blah, blah. And Dana White goes, I'm not that guy. I had to go up there and stand up for this guy because of what he did. Now, Donald Trump, for all the criticism that he has, they call him racist, bigot, misogynist. He's none of those things. And to the extent that I think people want him to be, what he is he sees people as commodities.
Yeah.
And helping Dana White is a smart, strategic business move using a guy who has a morality, right? Like, I'm not going to bail on this guy on this thing. Like, he sees the character. He sees those attributes of someone like Dana White, at least in this context, that he knows he can secure by helping and then call on that favor later on. That's the kind of mind you're dealing with. You're not dealing with a guy who's racist, who's bigoted. You're not dealing with that. Calling him that stuff isn't necessary. He might be those things deep down, but he works with black people because black people are a good commodity to him. He'll work with gay and lesbian people because it's a good commodity for him. It's an asset for him that he can abuse and manipulate. So the diagnosis of Donald Trump being all these things, and it's easy to not like him and all that stuff, but I think you have to go a little bit further to understand what you're looking at so people can go, hey, I'm supporting a guy who uses people as commodities, not a bigot and racist in the way that we are, and he's going to do that because he's using the office to serve him, not our country, in the way that he's contesting that he is. Now, I'm not going to say the left's any better at what they're doing, but I think understanding the mind of those people is where people can do themselves a better service so they can make informed decisions about who they're supporting and how they're supporting it. And it's not just Donald Trump. Hmm. It's a cast of these people, and it's a cast of these people on your team, my team, wherever we go. And you're going to run into them all the time. And you're going to run into low level people like that, that aren't as calm in the face of being accused of horrible things. They're just going to go, okay, I got it. But then there's people that are highly reactive that are like that as well and aren't going to be as powerful as someone like Donald Trump because they react in real time. So it's been an education, but understanding what they look like and sound like, I think, is the best thing people can do for themselves and arm themselves for that. And the best fight in those scenarios is the one that's not fought. Get away, cut them out of your life immediately. They'll only put stress in your heart. And I could feel it. My heart was hurting when I was going through these things. I was like, breathing. I could feel the years being taken off my life. You got to get them out of your life as soon as possible. And I'm fine. I mean, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying like the stress they cause to people who have a conscience, the stress they cause to people that are empathetic, it's devastating. And the world needs more empathetic people in positions of power too.
This takes us deeper down this rabbit hole, which I love, by the way, Nippy. And thank you for sharing your insight. It's kind of a philosophical question, but does the ends justify the means in some scenarios that I'm going to play these pawns this way? I'm going to make these decisions because, and granted, this is where you're getting a little bit culty in a lot of situations, we're going to play this card because it's for the better of X. It's for the better of the team. It's for the better of the community. It's what God would have wanted. So we need to tell, this is a stupid example. We need to say you don't look chubby in this because it's not beneficial. It's a white lie. And we just have a lot of white lies that justify a better end game for what we're trying to accomplish. Is that ever warranted or is that just fucking bullshit?
Well, the question I hear you asking is total disclosure and total transparency the best
A dumb example would be like, you know, New England Patriots taking a little bit of air out of the football to try to win. You know what I mean? Like, it's like tiny little things that are kind of to justify something that isn't tremendously malicious, but.
Well, here's my response to that. If that becomes the modality that people accept, it's ultimately going to get worse. So it's ultimately going to fail. And you can argue that all you want, but it's kind of, there's this book I kind of have as a little bit of a Bible. It's called Power Versus Force by David Hawkins. And it's anything that is rooted in some sort of forceful behavior and in sort of lie, coercion, or anything, it's always going to get worse. It's always going to extrapolate out because people are going to recognize that's the way to get what you want. Right. And if it's rooted or moored in any sort of ideology or principle, which theoretically the Constitution is the highest frequency document that's written because it's the first attempt to put these tenets that human beings have failed to uphold throughout history on a piece of paper and try and implement them into society. If what you're doing is rooted in those things, then it's more sustainable, right? Which is kind of like, you know, be the change you want to see. Then if people start to recognize, hey, you know, I pick up my own trash, I start to create that, I don't want to say utopian, but at least a world where people are sensitive to the right things, then the better chances of it thriving. And I just think if you're doing one behavior, you're going to get better ways of cheating as opposed to better ways of being a good human. And I think people also have to recognize the darkness lives in all of us. You know, you're not going to shame someone out of their own darkness by calling them out on a meme or a lie or a bad review of their podcast. It's just not going to happen. The best thing you can do is get sensitive to your own darkness. Here's one thing I do. Whenever I see something I disagree with online, I read a comment that supports my disagreement. If I feel good about that comment, I know I still got work to do, right? Because that's human, right? And you can't, like, the darkness that you might have in yourself is human, and that's ultimately on you to do something about it. And only you know, right? So that's the existential kind of like, can you put your own head on your pillow at night knowing that you're okay? And do you have a conscience that cares enough about it? Is it still alive? Has it been beat up too much? And a lot of people that seem high functional, like I have some friends that I went to school with that are in banking. And I just figured out I couldn't do that job. And a lot of them have a lot of money. They've gone the wrong way in life, in my opinion.
Right.
And in order to maintain the belief that they haven't participated in something, like, they have a lot of I can hear it in their voice. There's a lot of justifications for, like, why they have the money. It's a handful of guys, but
yeah,
their conscience is it's rationalized. And I just think that's a slippery slope. You know, once you do it, you get accustomed to doing it. It isn't an indictment on them. I get it. You know, you need to, you have your family to take care of, and there's probably some other principles that it's rooted in. You know, and I don't know the extent of it, but I can hear the justifications. And why do you need to justify? It's normally a portal to some sort of self exploration.
We could do eight hours on this, because
really
nippy. Like, I have a core belief that we make the best decision possible based on the data and circumstance that led us to that moment. So they might be on a completely different path. Doesn't mean they're bad people. Doesn't mean it's malicious intent. The rationalization is probably a sign that they see a little bit of vulnerabilities in the way they're living their life,
and they may correct it,
and they probably will correct it. The question is when, why, and how. And that's them making the best decision based on the data they received, and then they suddenly look at themselves in the mirror, they don't recognize themselves, and possibly make a change. That's everyone's journey. All that being said, what's crazy about this cult shit is some people aren't on that journey. They're legitimately like checking the boxes and like playing this like it's a freaking game. Now, granted, life kind of is a game. We kind of are actors on the stage, but don't we want to share it with other people? Some people are like malicious, and I don't know where to take the conversation other than it just blows my mind. And I told Sarah this. That's why I could binge on your podcast all day, because it just never seems ending. These people hiding in plain sight that aren't always the best, you know?
Well, I there's that. There's people like Keith who just emulate and like do not have a conscience, and they just emulate and they're chameleon like with
how
people.
How did you avoid not punching him?
It's a great question.
Not a very
A lot of people have asked me this, especially people that I knew before and I played sports with, knowing me, they're like, how did you not do it? And I can answer that. Really, I can answer it briefly and being like, I just didn't want to be a person that was going to handle the problems with violence. And as much as I wanted to, as much as I had to show restraint, I still want to be totally honest with you. There's still a part of me that really wants to just feed his head to the curb. And I just knew I wasn't going to be any help to my wife and kid if I was, you know, in some jail cell somewhere. And I know enough about violence to know that I just don't ever want to be in a violent situation. And that would have been much of a fight. I could have beat his ass with my eyes closed. But I didn't want to have to deal with authorities, and I didn't know what we could prove, and I didn't know what I was looking at. But I will say this.
Yeah.
When I'm in a moment of like driving in my car or in the gym or something like that, and I think about it, I still have that little part of me, that little brochacho brat, I call him. Like, you know, excuse my language here. It's like, you know, the narrative of like, you pussy, you let that happen. I had to really keep that guy at bay.
Yeah.
Throughout this whole thing. And like, cause there is a component, and it's totally irrational intellectually. It's totally irrational intellectually. And I totally get it. But on a primal level, like, I didn't protect my family. I let this happen, and I didn't get my pound of flesh after. There's still that kind of primal, immature, unrefined aspect of me that is still there, that I didn't get to scratch that itch. But it's faded with time, and he's rotting in a jail cell
for 100+ years.
He's rotting in a jail cell because I didn't do that. So
you're not concerned? Wasn't he a judo champion? You don't think he could fight you?
You know, I was willing to test that thesis. In fact, I was kind of curious. You know, you put that on your resume, and that was something you achieved when you were like 10 or 11 years old. I don't even remember my 10 or 11 year old achievement. So it's like, I don't know why that was on your resume. It was always something I kind of like joked. I was like, oh, you're going to do a judo kit? You know, it's like, so.
So Nippy, I left a super open loop that I want to close, because I think it's an important thing that ask. And then Sarah gave me a bunch of things to ask you. I didn't ask any of them because we just started shooting the shit. So we'll just ask with like a free association at the end.
Sure. But sure.
The open loop that we didn't close that I think is important is like, you're a football player, very masculine, don't really listen. Like, you're not like going with the crowd the way some people do. What was your buy-in? Like, were you an avid meditator that wanted to do inner work? Like, it seemed like you were the opposite of the kind of person that might join, but what was your buy-in?
It's an idealistic thing. Yanya Lalich has a book called Take Back Your Life, and there's a segment, and it's called Moral Injury. And the principles of the organization that it professed uphold about building an ethical world, you know, getting in touch with your emotional side, understanding yourself, those things, I felt like the world needed more of. I just read a book by Bill Bennett. It's called The Death of Outrage. And it was kind of like how people were just accepting Bill Clinton's behavior and not really holding the most powerful man in the world for having sex with an intern in his office. And the intern seemed the one to be the one on trial. And now, I'm not God's gift to morality, but I was 26, 27. I was like, you know, that is a problem. why aren't more people like calling for this guy's head, even in his own party, going, hey, that's a total abuse of power. You shouldn't be doing that. You need to get stepped down from this. And he doubled down, lied and all that stuff. And I just thought, you know, serendipitously, I had a friend tell me about this thing. I said no for about a year because it sounded like a cult. I actually said that to her. And I went and took it, and it kind of addressed that. It's like, if we have a world of more ethical people addressing these things, and it had that kind of tone to it. And I was like, you know what? That sounds, even if I'm not all in on this, I'm going to be aligned with this organization. And I was aligned with the organization peripherally for about 2 years, but I didn't really see strong leadership. And at someone that's 27, 28, I don't have a whole lot of influence in the world. And I didn't see myself as the guy who's going to spearhead that. So I decided to just not be a part of the organization in 2003, but not under any sort of hardship, or I wasn't angry. I stayed in touch with the organization. In fact, I think in 2005, I did a training because I was out, you know, I went, had a goals plan to it, right? And I liked, you know, kind of looking under the hood once a year. And instead of taking, you know, $3,000 to $5,000 and spending it on junk, I spent it on myself. That's how I kind of looked at it. And I would take the money aside and I would spend it, you know, because I also didn't want to make the company my job or work. And then about 2006, Mark Vicente calls me, and he's, if you know the story in the Val, he's one of the people that blew the whistle with us, you know, and said, hey, I have a film project. I was all living in LA. I have a film project for you to work on back in New York. And they moved me back, paid for everything, and to shoot this film. We went into pre-production and all that stuff. And when I came back, there was a lot of actors, a lot of directors, a lot of creative people. The organization had tripled in size. It had moved to Mexico, Monterey. And I was kind of eating my words, going, wait, this thing's actually catching on. Mm-hmm. They had way more influential people than it did 3 years ago. And I kind of felt like, I hate to use this word, but I felt like there's a lot of losers in the organization the year before. And I just wasn't interested in helping someone through their marriage when I was 27. Yeah. I wasn't qualified. You know, I was so, and I came back and I saw that.
Part of the marketing with executive success, right? It wasn't like people coming, starting from zero. These are executive, high-performing people, highly successful people trying to get that secret sauce that, similar to athletes, like, what is Kobe doing that someone who's not as good isn't doing?
Exactly.
So it makes perfect sense to me. Go on, please.
And so, it felt like the organization was closer to what I kind of theorized it could be in 2006. And I was like, this might be worth a look. And I'll shoot my film. I'll go back to LA and I'll stay more involved with the organization because it was growing. And that's kind of where the slow burn happened. The movie got postponed. Things didn't happen. I ended up being in New York, kind of working on other acting projects. So a lot of the things were still lining up, but not in the way that they told me. That should have been where I had a contract and said, I'm done. You guys said I was going to be here for a movie. It didn't happen. You're a success program. Why didn't you come through and what you say you're going to come through? I didn't hold that line. So I was constantly having these kind of disenfranchised moments with the organization. So for me, it was like a slow burn of like a lot of things and time being emptied out that I was investing, and I wasn't getting what I wanted in return.
Right.
But I still believed that the organization's heart was in the right place.
Correct. Right.
So that's what was keeping me in, my morality that I felt like I was a part of an organization that I was aligned with morally and principally. Once I saw what I saw, I recognized I wasn't, and it was like, boom, shift, boom, I'm done, I'm free. Because the thing that was tying me in was the fact that if I walk away from this, I'm walking away from my principles. Mm. And once I saw that it wasn't that, it was an easy shift, and I felt free. It's a really strange thing. I felt free from the shackles of like, I would be leaving something positive. And it was an easy pivot for me. And then once I saw my wife was abused and all that stuff, I kind of went into sniper mode. And to your point, like, you know, I wanted to use violence. It was all there, but I just knew I couldn't.
And nowadays, nonviolently, you're making a difference, and you guys laugh about it as well.
Yeah.
Sarah gave me
I have a weird sense of humor.
Sarah gave me a few things to talk about. I don't know if you have to run. I know you guys are tremendously
busy. I got about 10 minutes. Yeah.
I've spent like the whole 15. 2.5 hours with y'all. I appreciate you guys taking time.
Yeah, I know. It's no problem.
It's you guys are podcasters now. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
There's a couple of topics I want to bring up, and I kind of want to have you free joke with it because it's easier.
Yeah,
I
mean, for sure. Yeah.
Even while it was happening, to my understanding, you joked about some of these things, but now that it's already happened, it's like, what the shit was I doing? I actually don't know what this is. I wrote down Goals Labs.
Oh, yeah. The Goals Labs is basically what we called. This is what I ran primarily. I ran it virtually. When I was in the city, I'd do it in person, but I ran virtual LA, Vancouver, and New York City Goals Labs, and people would just come on with their weekly goals. And I would elicit from them where they were in their goals and then elicit their next step. And normally the next step was something in the physical world, like they had to go do something, or it was an emotional step. Like normally people quit their goals and it's an emotional limitation.
Right.
And that's what elicit from them and give them a next step to address it.
That's not cute or funny at all. That actually sounds like badass good advice. Like that's an example. Not everything in Nexium was trash. That's a great example.
No, people come to me.
Was anything about that bad? That just sounds like good advice and good mentorship.
No, not at all. In fact, I had some people come to me at the end and wanted me to go work in their company.
Oh.
And I was like, I'm done with this shit.
You don't want to be a consultant or anything like
know,
that?
You'd have to pay me a lot, you know, to make it worth my time. Because I just, it has a weird, I haven't done it since. And I'm pretty sure I could would be pretty good at it because I can hear it. But as a full-time job, I don't know. It depends. I would have to have someone reach out to me and go, hey, here's what I'm offering. And I'd be like, okay, pay me for results. Yeah. If I get you results, I'll take your money.
And by the way, these are all notes I made I asked Sarah, hey, what should I ask Nippy? And I just took a couple of notes. This one's a little spicier. So talk a little bit about V-Week and your opinion of it.
You know, V-Week kind of got blown out of proportion by the vow, but I didn't really care that it got blown out of proportion. Well, people are like, oh, that's so weird, celebrating his birthday for 10 days. That's not what it was for me. It was more of a corporate retreat. Everyone from all the organizations from around the world would come, talk about what they're doing, what's successful in the organizations. It's a great opportunity to see everyone that you didn't get to see as much year-round, especially like the friends I made in Mexico. For me, it was you got to do a lot of that. For me, there was a science aspect to it. There was always a subject like Buckminster Fuller, Einstein. There was always someone, there was like an expose on that person. I'd take my kid to it. We'd do that. I'd swim in the lake, work out, and then I'd eat steak off campus because there was no meat. So
it seems like as an outside observer, tell me if I'm wrong, is the fact you weren't as bought in as some people and you kind of had a foot out and you had your own life and you didn't live in Albany and you had your own interests was part of it, that you were able to take the good shit and not buy into the stuff that you weren't really feeling quite as much.
I wouldn't say I wasn't as bought in. I was bought in differently. Explain. And I think it's important. It's case by case. Like I explained, it was more my morality and those things. I wasn't bought in to thinking Keith was any greater than he was, although I did support what he said and the teachings and all that. But it was just a different kind of allegiance. I didn't particularly care about the stripe path because I didn't think it was particularly merit-based. I think they gave them away arbitrarily. So I didn't, going up the ladder in the organization wasn't interesting to me. I just didn't care.
That's literally another topic Sarah mentioned, the stripe path. So merit-based?
No, they gave it to people who they felt were important.
Huh.
You know, they had people grossly underqualified running things that they had no business running, and I could see that. So I just, to me, getting a promoted in something where this person is the same rank as me, but they're not as qualified or, you know, and so it wasn't interesting. So I had no real incentive to do that. So consequently, I was like, I think I was also left alone because you weren't going to out-logic me and gaslight me into doing things I wasn't going to do. I would just say no. And they said, well, you're defiant. And I'm like, fine. I just don't want to do it. Which was kind of, I'm not going to say it was because I saw anything that I didn't want to do. I wasn't a particularly good student in school because there was just no way you were going to sit me in a room to do something I didn't want to do. I had a really hard time with that.
I'm the same way.
I had a hard time just sitting in a room. You're not going to convince me why geometry is going to be important in my life. It was just not something that was going to happen. And there was no one there that could do it. And then I had an English teacher who explained to me kind of like poetry and like shit. And I was like, oh, and I did well in his class because I got why I was there. And there was just no, and if you couldn't convince me of why I was going to doing it and how it was rooted in the sort of real practical principle, there's no way I was going to fucking do it. Mm. And I was looking at the clock, you know, in school, like when does practice start? And that was kind of similar to the modules. I was like, I'm not doing this. I can't do it. Like physically, I'm not wired to sit there and listen to something that like, and I, if I thought you were full of shit, like then that was another strike against you. So I don't know. I'm not saying that like, you know, it's not a smarter thing. It was just more of how I'm wiring and how I was different. And I don't think it's an intelligence thing or I was less susceptible. I just think I bought in differently. And that was the extent that I was going to be bought in, no matter what. You know, it's why, you know, I left the organization for reasons that, like, I just didn't care for some of the people there and I didn't want to be around them. And when I came back for that movie, I think my boundaries were already established. And I was like, this is how I'm going to relate to this organization, no matter what. So when we got an apartment there or a condo there, it wasn't near where anyone else lived. It was near the airport and the bus station. Right. I would smoke weed and have a beer and watch the movie. I didn't want people knowing that and then being like, what are you doing smoking weed and watching the movie? I'm like, dude, I like to smoke a joint and watch a football game. Like, that's not.
Yeah. Well, what is not, it? You know, EMs? You needed EMs about that one.
I didn't need an EM about that. And I would and I would work out at odd hours. I would work out at like, you know, 9, 10 o'clock at night. And like, I didn't want them knowing anything. I didn't want them any more in my personal life than they already were. Which is kind of like why the vow was a little bit difficult as well. It's like, I didn't really want my personal life to be other people's entertainment. You know,
you're in it a little bit less than
a little
some
bit less.
People. Was that by your choice or did they?
Yeah, I kind of said to Kareem, I was like, listen, because Kareem would come to me and go, explain this. Cause I can put a lot of the language to this. I go, here's what's going on here. Here's what's going on here. He's like, do you want to explain that? I was like, I just did. He's like, do you want to do it on camera? And I'm like, all right. You know, and he got me on camera for the days that I was willing to do it. And then I was kind of like, hey man, I got a kid. And like, it's a lot of shots of me cutting away like this, you know? And they wanted me to come in and explain stuff. And I was like, you know, I think I've thrown my punch, you know? And then after June of 19, when I felt like, you know, he was convicted, I wanted out. I felt like, you know, I've done what I'm going to do. Sarah and I have done what we're going to do. I don't need this anymore. He's going to jail for 120 years. We won. I'm out. I want to, and a lot of valuable years of my life were emptied out. A lot of earning years of my life, you know, when you, in your 30s and 40s, you know, I was 43 when I got out. Like, you know, I want to see what I can do as a person, what my talents measure up to out in the external world. Because I, you know, a friend came to me afterwards, I'd built an organization of like 600 people. They're like, dude, that's a multi-million dollar company in some places. Like, you need to get, and I was like, you know what? I want to see what I can do out in the world in a fair market with my, and the only thing on my resume now is I was in a cult for 12 years. So, you know, I was, and still am, hungry to see, you know, how far I can take my ideas and actualize them in the world. And I had 12 years of emptying them out with really nothing that much to show for it, except this story. When I want to turn it, it's not going to be my narrative, and I'm going to turn it into something else. And I'm still ambitious to do that. And I'm still young enough to do it. So I kind of wanted to close that chapter as quickly as possible, heal myself, you know, make sure my head's okay and I'm not humiliated, embarrassed and all that, because that's going to affect how I move forward. And once I took care of that, opportunities started to open up and they continue to, and I'm going to keep exhausting it as long as people will, you know, will have us. And then if not, I'll pivot to something else and work hard in that. That's pretty much how I view it.
Well, I appreciate everything you guys are doing. I don't know how to cap a two-parter. I do want to ask you this. It's take your time if you need to, because it's 12 years. If you could take the 12 years in the struggle. And it's interesting though, like I just said, it's interesting. Isn't that kind of like a trigger? Kind of that's a key thing.
No,
but it's not. Interesting because like you met your wife and started a family. Like,
oh yeah.
It wasn't all bad. If you could take 12 years and sum up what you learned, what would you say were the biggest learnings from those 12 years?
Bet on yourself. No matter what, bet on yourself. Find out. That was it. Because I felt like a lot of times during that, I wasn't betting on myself. I was betting on the organization.
Mm.
And anytime I've been successful in anything, it's always been me betting on myself. Every single time. And this is the one time I didn't do that. I put my trust into something else. And no one's going to have your best interests at heart better than yourself and your friends and family.
And now that's Sarah, the biggest thing I can tell you. You guys are betting on each other.
Yeah. And my kids require me to keep it at a certain pace. I can't go at the pace I want with kids. So it's actually good. It helps me keep balance and having kids ground you and keep you in the present, which is extremely valuable, has been God sent. So those have been huge lessons as well.
You know, this is another tangent. We don't have to go down this road, but with all the work you guys are doing in a group like Nexium to be more present, to be more self-aware, to better yourself, you can just, not that I recommend this, but you can just pop out kids and they'll teach you all those things. You don't need to go through a freaking course.
It's true, man.
They'll teach you all that shit.
Life will teach you that.
Right.
Right? Life gives you the lessons you need until you learn it, right? It's going to keep feeding you the same lesson until you pivot to it. Mm. You know, there's, my dad's an architect, and one of his favorite architects, I guess his influence, is a guy named Le Corbusier. It's a quote my dad has in his office. Life is always right. And I like it. I mean, that sums it up.
Nippy, man. I've taken the afternoon. The listener has spent an afternoon with all of us, which I love. I really appreciate it. Little bit culty podcast. I was telling Sarah, I don't have it written down. I'm on season 5, like episode 11. I started from 0. So I've been binging. I'm up to season 5. I do recommend people. There's no harm in starting from the first episode and taking that journey. It's check out The Vow. Docuseries. I actually heard you guys on the Jordan Harbinger show. Then I watched The Vow. And then before you know it, I was binging the podcast. So I encourage everybody to do that same thing as well. And I want to just ask you, is there any other way that we can be supportive of you? Sarah and I mentioned, you know, someone can join the inner circle if they want to get in with the the Patreon.
Patreon
inner circle, the slightly culty vibes, but not really. But I would say
check out some of our episodes if you dig our vibe. Our Patreon, we get a little funnier on it and a little less diplomatic on it. I have a great Keith impression that I do on that, which is really funny.
Do you want to do a word salad or anything like that?
I can do word salad. Give me a topic and I'll show you how it works. I think it's important for people to get kind of the idea.
So
pick something.
Well, and this is actually something that's true, but so there's music, there's sports, there's success in life, entrepreneurship. It's all a performance art of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
People achieving top of their game. A peak athlete is often great in the military, is great in business. They just have something, a discipline, a commitment that's powerful.
So he would go something like, he'd be like, one might say that discipline is an art in and of itself, and mastering discipline is the discipline. Discipline can do many things. You can discipline yourself to be disciplined, which will then free you up for other disciplines. Or you might just say, I don't need discipline, which in and of itself is an admission to the need of discipline. I said nothing throughout the whole thing about discipline, but it sounds like I said a bunch of shit about discipline. I know what I'm talking about.
So
a lot of his forums were just chock full of shit like that. So
learning how to be disciplined is a discipline, and not disciplining yourself is a discipline one in oneself. So once you can transcend the need for discipline, you have achieved discipline, something like that.
Something, yeah. I mean, there you go. that was actually took it to the next. I mean, that's how it was kind of put, and you kind of go, "Is it me that's not getting that, or did he just talk out of his butt?"
And I rambled, but with the performance people being good in multiple disciplines, that's not incorrect. Is the word salad just to confuse people, or is it to
the word salad? Well, also, you know, I find word salad a lot of times obfuscating what you don't know, and trying to make the obvious sound profound. If I'm disciplined in one area, I'm going to probably be disciplined in another area. That's what you can just say in one sentence. Right?
Don't have to send someone a link or ask them to read a book.
Yeah. You don't have to appeal to authority. Yeah, exactly. Right? And then that's the end of the conversation. You can move on, but that's not what he was about. And that also gets you to do mental gymnastics. Wait, what did you just say? And then, like, if you're confused, you think it's you. And then you go find the meaning on your own, and then you attribute it to him.
You know, it's interesting, but it's, and I promise we'll close this out, but I listen to podcasts on the go all the time, and I found I couldn't listen to Keith speak in like his YouTube series. I couldn't listen to him speak and multitask. Like, I couldn't comprehend what he was saying. It was like in a different universe. So I think that's what they do.
That's what they do. That is I think what their objective is. It took me a while to figure that one out. Because I would leave some of the forums, and Sarah would be like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Dude, I can't. I'm just tired. I can't handle this shit anymore." It's the same shit.
Well, bro, I appreciate your time. I'm going to continue to listen. I know the listener is as well.
Appreciate it.
I encourage them to reach out, send a DM if they need a helping hand or they have a question.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah.
I want you to have the last word. Did we miss anything? We missed so much, but any last words for us?
You know, the thing that I would just say is if you dismiss this stuff, and you think you're not susceptible to it, I just consider that you are, and you already have been. And when you catch yourself dogmatic about your belief system, dismissive of other people for not having the same one, which is really what's going on right now, and then more so in the last 5-6 years than ever, you are in the dogma of extreme belief, and that's a little bit culty. It doesn't mean that like you're going to go about your day and be professing it, but like everyone right now with what's going on, social media and the extremes of politics and all that stuff, consider that what you're feeling right now is by design and not your own fruition. Consider that the identity politics that you feel aligned with is by design, and that it's in the division that you feel with someone who you probably didn't even consider an adversary 5-6 years ago is by design. And I think if you can do that, you can get sensitive to how these forces work, because the forces on either side of the dogma, it's the same person pulling the levers. It's just different content points, right? So your adversary who's armed with different content points is being formed by the same person that's informing your dogma. Hate doesn't care who it has. It just cares that there's more of it. And it will leverage whatever cause, whatever modality, whatever belief system to do, as long as there's more hate and violence, and it smiles when it wins. And that's about it. You know, I think for me, you know, I've been reading a little bit about, you know, Karl Marx and his predictions of capitalism and that stuff. We live in a pretty amazing country that's attempting to do things no other country has really done in this magnitude for a long time. And he writes, and I think in one of his things that I read recently, democracy, capitalism won't be destroyed by an outside force. It'll be destroyed from within. Mm-hmm. And these forces that are going on right now are forcing people to be a little bit culty with each other. And consider that you're a part of that division by aligning yourself with an extreme. Just consider it. I'm not saying you are. That's it. Thanks, consider, man. You might be a little bit culty sometimes, I guess.
Maybe one day you guys will put yourselves out of business. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
I hope so. I hope people say, Yeah, thanks. We're done with you.
I'm along for the ride until we get there, bro.
Great. I appreciate your support. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to all our episodes.
Thanks, man. We'll talk soon.
You got it.